I'm looking with Jodie Rowley at a most beautiful small pink frog. In fact, it's a picture because it comes from Southeast Asia, but it's got lovely big eyes and really the pink hue and those lovely tiny, almost like scales or prickles. What is it?
It's a thorny tree frog, Gracyxylus lumarius, and it was just named a couple of weeks ago. It was discovered by my colleagues and I in the tallest mountains in central Vietnam.
The Science Show, with some new frogs, new to us anyway. In a minute or two, a PhD like no other. She graduated last week at 93, the oldest in Australian history, and still bouncing like a 20-year-old. And you'll meet two of the top figures in world science, Dr. Margaret Leinen of Scripps and Dr. Marcia McNutt of the journal Science. Now back to Jodie Rowley from the Australian Museum and that pink frog. Is it very small?
No, not for a frog. About 4 centimetres in body length. As you said, pink and yellow, which are quite unusual colours for a frog. And males are covered in spikes made out of keratin, so the same kind of thing as your fingernails or rhino horn. So give it a sort of a sandpaper appearance.
And what are they for, do you think?
We're not sure, but the fact that the males have the spines and they seem to be more pronounced, much bigger in the breeding season, we think that it might be to do with recognition. So females come along, they feel the back of their potential partner. If it's spiky enough, then it's a male and maybe they'll mate. So they're breeding tree holes in the forest and so maybe they can't see that much when they're in the tree holes.
Now, you had another discovery of a small brown frog, rather less charismatic. What was that one?
That's Leptilelex botsfordi, which was found on the top of the highest mountain in Vietnam. So the first one, the thorny tree frog, is the highest mountain in central Vietnam, whereas Botsford leaf-litter frog was found on the tallest mountain in Indochina as well, in Vietnam, which is actually a bit of a tourist trail with people trying to climb it. So usually I'm in very remote places, but this small little brown frog that sounds like an insect was just chirping away not far from these huts in the mud on top of a mountain.
So there was enough wetness so that it could live there comfortably and not too cold?
For frogs, I guess it wasn't too cold. For me, it felt like an Antarctic base station. You know, the campsite was at 2,800 metres and it was just this one little stream and there was a bunch of really cool frogs. I spent about an hour, and it was about 11 degrees Celsius, on my hands and knees in the mud, in the fog, looking for this tiny thing. You think you're going crazy after a while. Maybe this is an insect. You know, I do study frogs and I think this is a frog, but maybe I've just lost it. And, you know, shaking and wet, an hour later, I finally found one of them. And then we found a few more and they look like a normal leaf-litter frog for most people, but I could tell that they were something special because they were much fatter, especially males had huge arms and lots of fat, probably in order to survive the winter where it actually snows in these mountains.
I'm most impressed because usually when I try to creep up on a frog, any frog, I mean, they just disappear. They just run away. But you persist and somehow you track them down.
Usually they don't run away. Usually they just sit there. But because they look like exactly whatever they're sitting on, you don't see them. So it just takes persistence, which I have some.
But you keep finding these. Is there no limit to the number of frogs, different species that may be hidden in Southeast Asia?
Well, at the moment, species discovery is still pretty exponential in terms of amphibians in Southeast Asia. So there's the really obvious ones, like the pink and yellow spiky frog, which was like, wow, this thing, I've never seen anything like it. I don't even know what genus this thing is in. And then there's the small brown frogs that maybe people have sort of known about, but they just assume that it's the same small brown frog that occurs everywhere else. And it's only when we look at things like DNA and call analysis and really start measuring fine details like the length of the different toes and the distance between the nostrils of the frog that we realise, hey, you know, they're small and brown because that works when you live in a leaf litter. But they are actually really distinct species. And so the discovery is a combination of going to new places, just being lucky and finding things that don't come down the trees often, and some really detailed collaborative work looking at a whole bunch of aspects of the frogs.
Well, just a detail of what is actually published in the journal Science, and I'm going to interview the editor-in-chief of the journal Science in a minute on this program, Dr. Marcia McNutt. Now, this article talks about the selection of, well, when you come across a new species, do you take a sample? Do you actually kill the creature and take it home so that you can do this detailed examination? Or do you worry about the fact that it might be very, very rare and just take a picture, maybe a few measurements at a distance and leave it at that. Some people were shocked at the suggestion in the journal Science that you should just leave it there. What do you think?
Well, I think that article starts with the premise that if you rediscover a species that you thought was extinct, so you've got a pretty good idea that it's very, very rare, then perhaps you don't need to take a voucher specimen, which is often needed to prove that something's one species or the other. And I think in those instances, particularly if you know what species it is, there's already specimens in the museums, then there potentially is no reason. If you've got a DNA sample that you can compare, you can just take a swab, take some photos, and that's probably enough evidence. In the places that I work and in a lot of places around the world, it's really quite impossible to identify what things are. People send me photographs of frogs and I can't distinguish between 30 species of small brown frogs from a photograph. So when discovering new species, we do take voucher specimens. We take hundreds of photographs of them in the field, take DNA, and we preserve them for eternity. And they become basically the library books of natural history museums. And they're lent around the world. They're studied many, many times. And forever, those specimens are that species. They're the types. They're really important. So I think it just depends where you work. I mean, in Central America, I know colleagues that have worked for 10 years doing ecology, and they missed 11 species of frog that they only discovered later using DNA. So they worked for 10 years at a site, taking photos, you know, handling the frogs, and there was 10 species that were undescribed right under their nose, but they're just so tricky to identify.
So you still have to take specimens. Well, we've talked before about this bonanza of discovery in Southeast Asia, and yet the area is being overwhelmed by human development. Do you think that will eventually wipe out the region?
I think you'll still get some species definitely around that are quite tolerant of human disturbance, but a lot of these frogs are really adapted to specific environments. You know, they'll build nests in the forest floor and the leaf litter, and as soon as you chop too many trees down, then it's not as humid on the ground anymore and they can't breed. Very sensitive to water quality and things like that. So in a lot of places, unless the forest is well protected and enforced, last year I did a couple of surveys in non-protected areas, and I was very upset to think that where we were surveying, we were basically probably recording data on frogs that wouldn't be in the same place in 5 or 10 years.
So you better keep up the work.
Working on it, definitely.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Dr. Judy Rowley is coordinator of the Australian Museum Research Institute in Sydney, and those extinctions put together have been called a possible sixth extinction, following the five others we've seen over the past 440 million years. Elizabeth Culbert has written a book about our present plight.
I think that we can see what links this current extinction event to the past extinction events is a very dramatic change going on at a rate that many species can't adapt quickly enough to. And that is unfortunately what's going on and why we are in danger of precipitating another very, very serious extinction event, because we are changing the world, and ocean acidification is a very good example of that. You know, reefs have gone out in the past. There have been moments in time when there have been no reef-building organisms. And those are associated with some of the worst crises in the history of life. So that is not something to take lightly at all. That's something to take very, very seriously.
What are the scientists saying? I mean, for example, is there agreement that a mass extinction event is occurring, but the only dispute is whether humans are causing it, or is it more like climate change, where 97% agree that there is a human fingerprint?
I think certainly there's no question that there's a human fingerprint in very, very elevated extinction rates that we have right now. I don't think there's any scientist who would dispute that at all. It's very, very hard to find an organism that's threatened or has gone extinct where you can't point to the human influences that led to that, or at least contributed to it. But I think the only dispute would be, well, these mass extinctions of the past have wiped out 3/4 of the species on Earth. I mean, that's sort of the threshold for these events. Clearly, we have not yet wiped out 3/4 of the species on Earth. So the only question I think that people would raise is, well, has this yet risen to the level where we can say we're in a mass extinction, or should we just say we have very elevated extinction rates, and if they keep up, we will be in a mass extinction? So that's a somewhat more subtle point, but I really don't think there's anyone out there who would argue that humans have not brought about a very, very high level of extinction, way, way higher than at any point since the dinosaurs went out, really.
Staff writer from The New Yorker magazine, Elizabeth Culbert, with Greg Borschmann from RN Breakfast. More on her book, The Sixth Extinction, next week in The Science Show on RN. Can we learn, then, from past crises? That, too, is the subject of this week's PhD with a Difference. Dr. Liz Kirby graduated last week from the University of Sydney, aged 93, and you're about to meet her.
This is Rudy Valley again, stepping perhaps a bit out of character in singing a song from Americana, a song that has taken its audiences by storm, which may be explained by its theme, which is both poignant and different. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Dr. Kirby, welcome to the Science Show studio. Would you please give me a summary of your thesis?
Well, the thesis is based on the experience of the 1930s Depression, because it still has relevance today, particularly in the wake of the global financial crisis. And I think that the crisis has revived the horrors of the Great Depression for some older people in Australia. However, a new generation of bankers and financiers appear to have no understanding at all of the impact of economic orthodoxy on the unemployed in the 1930s and what might be the effect on the unemployed today. In the 1930s, the unemployed were forced below the poverty line by administrations following the ideology that insisted that the repayment of debt had to take precedence over a need to create jobs. Also, the prosperity of the 1990s has allowed policymakers to ignore the social implications of austerity measures, and important initiatives which were introduced in the 1930s. Many economists believed that the Great Depression could never happen again because the world had moved on. Paul Krugman cites Alan Greenspan, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve in America in 2005, and stated, increasingly complex financial instruments have contributed to the development of a far more flexible, efficient, and hence resilient financial system than the one that existed a quarter of a century ago. However, GFC has proved Greenspan's optimistic assessment to be false. And in 2013, in an essay that was published by the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs, Greenspan admitted that he never saw it coming. Although Australia, of course, has been lucky to avoid the worst of the GFC, Britain, Europe, and the United States are still trying to rebuild what were once robust economies and, of course, trying to control unemployment.
Thank you. And that was an excellent summary of your thesis. And the fact that you are 93, having just been doctored, if you like, is astonishingly enough. But the fact you read it with no glasses, how come?
Oh, that came of having cataract operations. I didn't realise when I was told by the ophthalmologist it would be a good idea to have the cataracts done that it meant I could go without glasses. But, I mean, that has been the result. I had the cataracts done last year, just over 12 months ago, and now I can read that size print without glasses. And when I'm being tested in the office and you read that chart, I can read everything except the bottom two layers.
Isn't that astounding?
I find it amazing.
I still need, I'm slightly younger than you are.
Yes.
I need these glasses. What made you decide to do a PhD later in life?
Well, after I retired from Parliament, I bought a sheep and wheat property in the Riverina in Tamora outside Wagga Wagga, And I was very busy and everything was going well for the first 2 years, and then we hit the 10-year drought, which wasn't very good for sheep and wheat, particularly for wheat. And I was also feeling that it would be a good idea, being an old lady, not to waste any more money on propping up property that wasn't at least covering its expenses. And at the same time, I decided that I would attempt a degree by distance education at Charles Sturt University in Wagga Wagga. And I completed the degree and went on to do an honours year. And my thesis for the honours year was the impact of the Great Depression in Britain, as demonstrated through the books and films and popular music of the era, which, of course, was my childhood, so I remembered the music. And when that was completed in 2009, of course, we were just hit by the global financial crisis. And I thought, by that time, I knew I was coming back to live in Sydney. Wouldn't there be a master's in the impact of the Great Depression in Australia? And I went to see Professor Greg Patmore, and Greg was terrific. Initially, he just said, oh, keep writing, send it to me. But in the middle of the first year, he suddenly read what I'd written so far and said, come on, this is going to be a PhD. And I was shattered. I mean, I never thought it was possible to sort of do such a quantum leap. However, he persuaded me and I started on the thesis.
It's bad enough for students getting the confidence at any level, but for you in a different situation like that, did you ever feel, oh my gosh, this can't happen, it's taking too long, or do I have what it takes, or you know, just being back in academe again?
Yes, oh, definitely all of that. I mean, when I'd done the honours degree at Charles Sturt, for the first time since I was 17, I had to sit an end-of-year exam. And you go into the examination hall, you go and sit where your number is, and you wait, and then you are told, now you can start writing. And you start writing. And it was, for the first 10, 15 minutes, it was terrifying. But then, of course, I realised when I looked at the questions, well, of course you can answer that. And I went on scribbling and scribbling until my writing was almost illegible. So I thought, well, I managed that, so I can manage another go at something.
Well, if you can manage the stage and television and who knows, Parliament, especially in New South Wales, you can handle anything, surely.
I don't know. I don't think that they were really training grounds for writing a thesis.
Obviously, you've been asked by a number of people around about your age whether it's actually worth doing something like that. What do you say when you get that question?
Well, I had been informed by scientists that in old age, if you didn't want to lose your marbles, either you use them or you lose it. So I was determined that I would attempt not to lose my marbles. Therefore, I would put them under test.
I think you've got more marbles than Moses Kirby. Thank you very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
Say, don't you remember they called me Al? It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal, buddy, can you spare a dime?
Dr. Liz Kirby. This is The Science Show on RN. I'm Robin Williams, and you'll know that the journal Science is one of the top four or five in the world, and the new editor-in-chief is Dr. Marcia McNutt. This week, she was at the Vatican for a top-level conference. In January, she was in China meeting the Premier Li Keqiang, and she writes, Our meeting made the 7 p.m. national news and was all over the morning papers. Even cab drivers knew about the meeting and were impressed. Scientific research had attained rock star status in China. If the long-term result is that China's most talented youth become researchers, then we all win, she wrote. So much for China, but what about the dire record back home in America? Here's Dr. Marsha McNutt at the AAAS. It's been a bumpy patch, of course, politically in the United States. Do you think science really has suffered at this time when the Chinese and various other parts of Asia are really burgeoning and going so fast? And America seems in many ways to be floundering.
Well, that certainly is the view of American scientists. There have been a never-ending stream of events, everything from the sequestration to the shutdown, to declining science budgets, to assaults on science in the form of travel restrictions for government scientists. This is one of many science meetings I've been at where government scientists are almost absent, because government scientists are not allowed to travel to meetings anymore. Their presence at meetings like this has been relegated to watching them through webinars. They have a very difficult time presenting their own papers. I think that this is, number one, making government science in particular a very undesirable career path for young people. It is hurting government funding for science to an extent where I'm concerned about the long-term viability of U.S. strength in many scientific fields, and morale is really at an all-time low.
What could turn it around, do you think?
I think we really need to see a lot more leadership, both on the administration side and on the congressional side, that makes it clear that no matter what the budget situation, and I think scientists are very understanding of tight budget situations, but makes it clear that scientists don't need to be punished, and that a lot of these policies that have been put in place, for example, that discourage foreign scientists from traveling to the U.S. and make it difficult for foreign students to come and study here, policies that make it difficult for just overall an anti-science attitude. I think before they even start looking at the financial situation would be extremely helpful.
Dr. Marsha McNutt, now editor-in-chief of the journal Science. Having been appointed, she's now talking about launching a new journal online to expand the publishing of top research results. Science is part of the AAAS, that's the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and that's where I met this tall, striking figure. But where's she from?
Well, I had been on the senior editorial board of Science for a number of years when Don Kennedy was editor-in-chief, and for a short while Bruce Alberts was editor-in-chief, but then had to step down when I accepted the political appointment to join the Obama administration. And I love Science magazine. I was very familiar with it. And I was intrigued by the opportunity to become a leader in what I felt was a critical phase in science publishing, because there are so many things happening in terms of new ways to make material accessible to readers, new ways of making science come alive, and in particular, new ways to deliver results in understandable forms to those who are the ultimate users of the scientific information, such as the public and policymakers. So I think I've always been passionate about scientific communication, and science is a great platform for that.
Just a thought about Don Kennedy and one of his editorials. I discussed it with him on the Science Show before. I think it was headed debate over, and of course it was about climate change, and it was trying to suggest that there was so much evidence from so many different kinds of sources that evidence was in fact overwhelming that we could see climate change being connected with human activities, and that it was
happening at a rate which was somewhat alarming. But an awful lot of people took umbrage at that headline as if anything can ever be over in a debate in science. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Don that the reality of a serious anthropogenic signal is agreed upon by the vast majority of the scientific community. The reason why we continue to have shadows of doubt on this is not really a scientific issue, but really a sociological issue. Because right now we don't have a simple solution for how to replace greenhouse gas emitting technologies with ones that will continue to support our quality of life and economic growth, there are far too many industries, as well as just individual citizens, willing to cling to any shadow of a doubt and use that to discount climate change because there isn't yet a solution. And I'll contrast, for example, the situation of climate change with that of the ozone hole. When the problem of the ozone hole was proposed and scientists started raising concerns about the increased probability of incidence of skin cancer and other problems, especially for people down in Australia and New Zealand and living in the southern hemisphere, again, there were all sorts of reasons why people could have thrown doubt at it, that there might have been natural oscillations, there could have been things other than the chlorofluorocarbons. But the beautiful thing was there was a replacement for the fluorocarbons. And so people could go on living their normal lives. They could go on having refrigerators. They could go on having spray bottles. They didn't have to give up everything they loved about their lives. And so the Montreal Protocol was signed. It went through. And there wasn't a concerted effort to cast doubt on the science. And until we come up with a simple way to go on with our lifestyle, the doubt about climate change will continue to happen.
It's interesting, only the other week from the University of New South Wales, Professor Matt England has published work on showing how the pause may have originated through absorption of heat in the oceans.
Yes.
And the act of various
Yes.
winds. It's very interesting.
Yes. We covered it in science, even if it wasn't published in science.
Yes. So the science itself does catch up. Two questions about your journals. One of them, of course, about the journal Science itself, before I get onto the new publication, which is very exciting. What really is the role of what's been called an elite journal in this changing circumstance?
First of all, science and the other elite journals have incredibly rigorous processes that they put their papers through, which include multiple levels of screening. In the case of science, it goes through a first screening by an editor, then a screening by our board of reviewing editors, then a screening process by reviewers who are experts in the exact field of the paper before that paper has a chance of being published. And so it's this rigorous process that we believe results in only 6% of the papers being published. So it's gold standard. Secondly, what science provides is an overview of the top papers across all fields. And for busy people who want to be able to go one place where they can read papers that give them an overview of the top developments across all fields of science, and they don't have to wade through hundreds of papers to try to find the cream of the crop, science does that for them. And third, because science has a number of professional news writers and editors who then distill that scientific information. And in the front of the journal, through our news articles and our perspectives and our short summaries of the papers, they take all that scientific information and they write precise but yet intelligible summaries of the work, and they put it in context. They make that work accessible to people well outside of the field. And so I think for those three reasons, the elite journals like Science and Nature provide great value.
It's a one-stop intellectual shop. Perfect. And yet you're bringing out an open access magazine in just over a year.
Yes.
Why are you doing that?
Well, it's very simple. When I first got to Science Magazine, I realized that out of every 100 manuscripts that were submitted to the magazine, we sent about 20 out for review, and we published only 6 of them. Of those 14 that we didn't publish, they were all getting published in pretty high-quality journals that weren't science publications. So the analogy for me, thinking as a business person, is imagine I have a restaurant and I've got a line of diners going out the door and I'm cooking meals for my diners, but I only have 6 places in my restaurant to feed them, but I'm cooking 20 meals. I sit 6 diners down and give them meals. 14 people, I send them down the street to someone else's restaurant and they pay someone else, because basically in our review process, we improve those papers so that they can get published in really good quality journals. And then the other 80 people, we just send away. Now, do I sound like a very smart businesswoman? No, I sound like my restaurant's going to go out of business pretty quickly. So in starting this new journal, we want to keep with science's reputation for publishing high quality papers. After all, that's what science is all about. And we know those 14 people we're sending down the street, those are really high quality papers. And sometimes it's really a judgment call which 6 we publish and which 14 we've sent down the street. So by starting this new journal, we can publish more papers that we know are high quality. Now, you might ask the question, well, why don't we just publish more papers in science? Well, we can't do that because we are limited by our page budget. And that page budget is set by our revenue streams, by how many ads we sell and how many subscriptions we have, and it basically hasn't increased.
And you send out the journal to members of the AAAS as well?
Yes, members. When they become members, they get a subscription. That's part of their membership cost. And advertisements have not been increasing. They've been decreasing. It just doesn't seem to be a growing revenue stream. So we're limited by how many pages we have to print. And we still have many print readers. People love to read science in print. So we can't get rid of the print magazine and just publish more papers by going purely online. So the easiest way to publish more papers was to have a journal that's online only, and by making it open access, we can say the only thing that is going to limit whether your paper gets published or not is whether it meets our standards for quality.
I presume, of course, you'll charge for this access.
No, we'll charge to publish the paper. The journal will be open access.
I see. And presumably people who are going online will know of your reputation and therefore know that out of the thousands, if not tens of thousands, of different publications all over the place, if they know that it's the Journal of Science and the Association, this is the quality that you described before.
Yes, yes. What will set this journal apart in terms of open access is, first of all, most open access journals so far have been narrow. You know, they've just been in the life sciences, or they've been in ecology, or they've been in physics. This one will be set apart because it encompasses all that science encompasses, and even more. We hope to make it even broader. And secondly, it's going to have very high standards. And internationally, I think this is going to be huge because everyone internationally will be able to get at it.
The editor-in-chief of the journal Science, Dr. Marcia McNutt, formerly head of the Geological Survey in America and of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. Yes, a marine scientist. And she did her PhD at the renowned Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which also now has a new chief. Dr. Margaret Linen has succeeded Australia's own Tony Haymet there. And she has a massive challenge ahead.
Scripps is 110 years old, and we have almost 2,000 people at the campus. Of those, 600 are volunteers that volunteer in science and at our aquarium. Probably another 350 are graduate students and other students that spend most of their time here at Scripps. 90 research faculty, another probably 250 project scientists, other people with PhDs, and the rest are staff.
And excluding China, it could well be one of the biggest marine science institutions in the world.
That's right.
And famous, of course, for the Keeling Curve, which was that begun by Keeling about 60 years ago?
It was started in 1955 and really became established in 1957. It was started by Charles David Keeling, and he was interested in whether there was variability in CO2 in the atmosphere. And it didn't take him very long to find out that there was variability, and he, of course, was thinking about the variability caused by Northern Hemisphere seasonality. So during the winter, the leaves fall off the trees are not photosynthesizing, and so they're not taking up as much CO2. During the summer, they are. So just a couple of years, he saw that effect, but he was also interested in other kinds of variability. And after a very few years, he could see that there was a small but subtle increase in CO2 taking place. And it wasn't too long after that that the hypothesis was formed that that increase in CO2 was due to emissions from fossil fuel burning.
And of course now it's passed 400 parts per million, has it not?
It has passed 400 parts per million on a specific day, but it hasn't passed 400 parts per million average.
I see there's a strict difference because as people indicate, the acidity of the ocean varies right across in various seas. It's not a uniform thing, is it?
That's right. Mm. So the acidity of the ocean, or its pH, on average, fairly constant with time, and we know that from being able to measure fossils and indicators of pH in them. But over the ocean, it varies in response to the uptake of CO2 from the atmosphere, the activity of phytoplankton in the ocean, who also photosynthesize and take up CO2. So on a short term in the ocean, there's quite a bit of variability. The thing that people are concerned about now is the longer term uptake of all of the CO2 by the ocean. And just like a bottle of soda pop, which has CO2 dissolved in it to make it fizzy, it also makes it acidic. So your soda pop has a pH that's very close to lemon juice.
Not very good for the teeth.
Not very good for the teeth. And so the more CO2 we dissolve in the ocean, the more we push it in the direction of lower pH. And that process is called acidification.
Yes, there's a study published 2-3 weeks ago in Australia showing that the eyes of fish are being affected by this. Ooh. So that they can't see properly, and they're worried about small fish, of course, not being able to see predators as they used to.
I'm not familiar with that work, but there's a lot of work going on now to try to understand the impact of acidification. And we know the impact on many kinds of organisms. For example, corals that make their skeletal material out of calcium carbonate, chalk, are affected in their ability to make those skeletons by the pH of the oceans. There are some organisms whose larvae are very susceptible to slightly more acidic water. So, for example, the larvae of shellfish are very susceptible. And in Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest of the U.S., they're already seeing instances where upwelling waters with lower pH are harming the larvae from oyster culture.
And of course, at Scripps, you're studying all of this. Now, it's very interesting. Some people talk about evidence concerning climate change and its various effects. Now, when you've got so many different strands of information coming through, you know, you've got maybe 20 different sources of evidence and they're all coming together telling the same story, and many of those sources are being studied here at Scripps.
More like the modern Sherlock Holmes with all of that mathematical and high-tech approach. So, yes, it's a very, very complex board game, and it requires a lot of different approaches to studying global change, because it's not just climate. We talked about acidification, changes in the distribution of species. Those are impacts of climate change. And today, scientists around the world are looking at all of those aspects. They're looking at the way that this will affect us, sea level rise. My previous home in Florida is already experiencing flooding of the streets during high tides that didn't happen 20 years ago. And it's a result of the small but inexorable sea level rise associated with the warming of the oceans and with melting of ice on land.
And are all these different strands of evidence telling the same story?
Well, it's writing different chapters of the same story. And there are many parts of it that we don't understand very well. A great example is 10, 15 years ago, we found out that the upper atmosphere high above us was actually cooling, while the lower atmosphere was warming. And, you know, scientists and non-scientists were all scratching their heads saying, does this mean that our assumptions about climate change were wrong? And as we studied that and began to understand the physics of the atmosphere and its reaction to solar radiation and to the warming of the Earth, we found out that that was exactly the predictable case. So many of the things we find out are puzzles to us, but well over 95% of the scientists around the world believe that climate is changing, that it's having profound impacts on us, on ecosystems, on precipitation, and so forth, and that this is of great concern.
What about your own work? Now you're director. Are you going to continue to stay at the bench, if you like?
I no longer engage in field research or laboratory research. I still write scientific papers with my colleagues. My own research has been in the field of paleoclimate, so climate change in the past. And there are many things that we can learn from looking at how ecosystems responded to past climate change, how fast climate changed in the past, which portions of the Earth system changed. And those are very helpful to us to understand what's going on now.
Well, congratulations on your appointment and also having one of the best offices in the world, just virtually on the beach.
That's right. And your listeners may be able to hear the faint sound of the surf outside. All of the doors and windows are closed, but it's still very noticeable in here.
The lucky and formidable new director of the great Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Dr. Margaret Leinen. And let's now stay on dry land and look at some rocks of a very special kind. I'm pretty sure you won't have seen anything like these before, though they seem ordinary enough. My guide is Meenakshi Wadhwa, and we call her Minnie after a story by Rabindranath Tagore from India. And she too, yes, is from India, but is a professor in Arizona.
So we are in the meteorite vault here on the campus of Arizona State University. And it is a state-of-the-art facility, probably better than at most museums, major museums.
For keeping meteorites?
For keeping and storing meteorites. And we have probably in excess of 2,000 different meteorites in our collection at this point.
Minnie, why have you taken me over here to this particular one?
If you look at some of these rocks, are you familiar with earth rocks, looking at sort of basalts around? They look very similar, right?
They certainly do.
They don't look like any other sort of unique meteorites. They're basically rocks from Mars.
So they're Mars.
They're pieces of the crust of Mars that got ejected out into space as a result of a huge impact or multiple impacts and were blown out into space, and they've eventually made their way to the Earth. And if you look at them closely, I would be hard put to say that these are meteorites if I didn't see sort of the defining characteristics like fusion crust, you know, the black rind that forms on the outside of some of these things.
So if you're looking at the ground, how do you know to pick up this particular dark grey rock?
If you didn't see that fusion crust, you'd be very hard put to really tell. But when you look at the chemistry and you look at the detailed, you know, mineral makeup of these things, they are different.
So do you know who picked this particular setup? There's one from India.
Well, at the current time, there are actually about 125 or so different meteorites that we believe come from Mars. But most of these have been collected just within the last 10 years from desert places in the Sahara and other desert regions of the world. But before that, Shigadi, for example, the one in India, that fell in the 1800s, 1862, I believe. And it was known as a very strange rock, but it was not until the mid-80s that we started to recognize that these things most likely came from Mars.
So you knew that the particular chemistry was familiar and would identify it as coming from only that one place?
We basically knew that there was something weird about this rock in terms of its chemistry, its mineral makeup. And there had been some suggestion that they had to have come from a large planet, not a small asteroid. Like most other meteorites are thought to come from small asteroidal bodies. But there was something about the chemistry there that seemed to indicate a larger planet as the origin. But we knew definitively they came from Mars in the 1980s when there were some studies done of some trapped gases in these things that have the exact composition of the Mars atmosphere. And we didn't know the exact composition of the Martian atmosphere until 1976 when the Viking mission happened. And so we had that point of comparison at that point, and we were able to make that connection. But it's kind of a neat little detective story, really.
And they travel all the way here without being burned up. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, actually it was interesting because some people had gone out on a limb and suggested that these rocks like Shigadi came from Mars. And there were people that do dynamical studies, and they basically said, well, there's no way that the physics would allow these rocks to travel intact from the planet of Mars to the Earth. But as we now know, they certainly did, and so there are ways of doing it. There's a finite probability of getting material from every planet in our solar system on the Earth as a result of impacts.
Even Mercury?
Even Mercury. It's a much smaller probability. It's very, very unlikely, but there could be a Mercurian meteorite. In fact, there was a suggestion, and we have a possible Mercury meteorite out in the exhibit area. I don't personally believe it's a Mercurian meteorite. We've actually done age dating work on it, and it's very, very old. It probably is maybe 1 million or 2 million years younger than the age of the solar system, which for a large planet to have a crust and have generated that rock, it probably would have taken a little longer than that. So I don't think it's a Mercurian meteorite.
Show me another of your favorites.
Another of my favorites is, well, actually, before we move on from Mars meteorites, this one is actually a very unique Mars meteorite. This is one that fell only 2 years ago. It's called Teasant. And the reason why this is really pretty unique is that of all the Mars meteorites that I just talked about, the 125 or so, there's only 5 before this particular one that were observed falls. So they were actually seen to fall on the Earth. They were picked up soon after, so they're very fresh in essence. They've not been sitting around on the Earth's surface and getting weathered and things like that.
That's why it's in a protective case.
It's in a protective case in a low humidity environment because we want to protect that rock from getting contaminated. And so, yeah. So if people, you know, that are looking to study organics and Martian meteorites, that's the rock to study. So
it's a big chunk, isn't it? Wow.
It's actually the largest piece of that meteorite in the United States. There is, I believe, a larger piece at the Natural History Museum in London. But that's the way it goes. Here's another really neat rock here. This is actually a piece of the moon. This is actually what we call a breccia. So it's sort of broken up in different fragments, and there's impact melt, the dark veins in here. And it's a very light-colored rock. And so this is thought to come from the highlands portion of the moon. And I think the first lunar meteorite was actually identified in 1980, and we could make the direct comparison with Apollo samples, and so we could tell right away when we found this is a moon meteorite. So yeah, so we've got actually the Apollo samples that sample a very sort of limited portion of the moon, but these meteorites are really important because they actually give you a much more random sampling of the moon and give you a better picture of what the surface of the moon really is like.
They brought back an awful lot in the Apollo missions, didn't they?
They sure did. We've got about 800 pounds of moon rocks that were brought back by the Apollo missions.
Still being worked on.
In fact, very actively being worked on. If you look at papers that have been submitted to the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Houston, it's an annual meeting of planetary scientists. There has actually been a huge resurgence of interest in studying moon rocks, particularly studying the water in these things. And in fact, there's been new work that suggested that the moon's not quite as dry as we thought it might have been in the past. Just to try to understand where that water is coming from. Is it from cometary impacts? Is it from the interior of the moon? And it has something to do, obviously, with how the moon was formed and its history after that. So it really is kind of an interesting question to look at. So,
what about your own research? Do you do work apart from looking after them and categorizing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So my own interest is in isotope cosmochemistry is what I do. I'm very interested in timescales. I do age dating of meteorites, and so basically trying to figure out what the age of the solar system is and what the sequence of events was that led to the formation of planets.
We're still about 4.5 billion years old, are we?
We are, but what we've done is actually very precisely date the formation of the solar system to 45, 68 million years, give or take about, you know, less than a million years.
Another sample.
Okay, so here is actually a really cool one. This one, actually, you get to do a sniff test. See, I'm going to open it. It's going to go away really quickly, but you got to smell this. What do you smell?
Is that acetone?
No, it's actually it's sulfur compounds and other volatile materials that are in this meteorite. This is an Australian meteorite, by the
Murchison.
Way. Yes, you're probably familiar with
Victoria.
It.
Victoria.
Yes.
Yes.
So this is actually a really interesting rock because it fell in 1969 in Australia, and it belongs to a group of meteorites that are very carbon-rich, so it's a carbonaceous chondrite. And 1969 was also the year when the Apollo moon rocks were brought back. And so there were a lot of labs that were geared up around the world to study these moon rocks, and this meteorite fell in that same year. And a lot of people obviously jumped on it to study it, and so this is probably one of the most well-studied meteorites ever. It's also the meteorite in which the first particles of pre-solar grains, dust grains, stardust, were separated from in the 1980s.
So presumably that was much larger, and that's a portion of it, is it?
It's a much larger meteorite. Yes, there's about 100 kilograms total of this meteorite. And this is just one piece, individual piece. It fell as many different stones. The black fusion crust on this one, it's almost complete. So this is actually a fully crusted stone. So it actually broke apart high up in the atmosphere again and essentially fell to the Earth's surface as a shower of stones, basically.
People noticed it at the time coming down, did they?
They did, absolutely. Yeah. It was collected very quickly. There's actually, it's interesting, you see some of the dirt and stuff on it?
Mm.
That's from where it originally fell. And this is one of the most well-studied meteorite for organic materials in it as well. You know, it fell in a field, and so there's a lot of dirt and manure and whatnot on it. But the inside...
Manure.
Yes, well, I mean, it fell on some kind of farm, I guess. I mean, you can actually see stones of Murchison that have a lot of gunk on them, but the interior of the stone is still actually pretty pristine.
And they're all fairly small ones. You've got some gigantic ones over there. Things.
Yeah, so we've got some big... Our biggest ones are actually iron meteorites, and some of them, the bigger ones, are actually sitting outside the vault because they're actually sitting on these pallets on the ground. They're too heavy to actually lift up and put on top of these display surfaces.
Meenakshi Wadhwa is director of the Center for Meteor Studies at Arizona State University, Minnie to her friends and family. Next week I'll talk to Steve Jones about God and Paul Meredith about solar power. And soon you'll find a video of Liz Kirby, PhD, on the Science Show website. Production by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams, if you can spare a dime.